You're listening to the Bitcoin.com podcast, the number one place in the world to learn about Bitcoin. Open your first wallet, buy your first Satoshis, and get involved in the Bitcoin ecosystem that is changing the world as we know it. Satoshi Nakamoto, wherever you are, thank you for making all this possible. Now, let's get started.
Hi, this is Rich Jacobs with Bitcoin.com podcast. Today, I have a very, very special guest, a guy that's been in the cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, blockchain world for quite a long time, Jeremy Gardner. How you doing, Jeremy?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You have a pretty extensive background. You've got your hand in a lot of things. Would you tell folks just an overview of how you first got involved in the blockchain and Bitcoin space, and then we'll go from there?
Sure. It's a fairly serendipitous story. I was working in politics as a progressive, working for mostly liberal politicians in Massachusetts, first for the governor of Massachusetts and then for the woman that's now Attorney General of Massachusetts, Mara Healey. And during my time working kind of at those high-level offices, I became first very disillusioned with the bureaucracy that I saw in politics, then secondly with the role that money played firsthand. And I realized that if I was going to do politics throughout my 20s, I was just to spend my time raising money for people. And there was a point at which I realized, you know what, maybe I should go out and figure out how to make money for myself and then influence these people. And I didn't really know what that meant. And for about 3 months, there's this like kind of massive void in my life. And I didn't really have a sense of purpose. I'd always thought I was going into politics. And then I ended up transferring to the University of Michigan, where I happened to move in with a young Bitcoin entrepreneur by the name of Kennard Hockenmull. He had an early Bitcoin startup called Bitbox. And I happened to move in with a bunch of his fraternity brothers, and he was crashing in one of the rooms, and he convinced me to start looking at this technology seriously. This was at the beginning of 2014. At the end of 2013, I had bought a bunch of Bitcoin during the run-up, but I had sold before the crash at around $1,000. So I was happy with myself, but I hadn't seen much value in the technology. I thought it was good for buying drugs online and as a speculative asset. I didn't see much function or utility in what Bitcoin had to provide. But right. Kennard got me to look at this technology in a more serious way, and he convinced me to join the Michigan Bitcoin Club. Who knew that was a thing? And when I did that, I started to do a deep dive on the tech, and at the very first Bitcoin Club meetup, a reporter from USA Today came. She was asking us about her Bitcoin Club and asking us about Bitcoin. I didn't know that much about it. But about halfway through the call, she mentioned that there were other Bitcoin clubs at MIT and Stanford. And at that moment, the political animal in me kind of activated. And I realized that there was a great organizing opportunity. And by the end of that night, we were on a call with, we being the head of the Michigan Bitcoin Club and I, with the heads of the MIT and Stanford Bitcoin Club. And, you know, they're talking about their respective successes and failures, talking about sharing resources, speaker, company contacts, and so forth. And I was like, why don't we create an organization out of this? And within about a month, the College Cryptocurrency Network was born, now known as Blockchain Education Network. And within about 6 months, we had over, I want to say, 100 chapters in 20-plus countries, every habitable continent. It just took off. And that was kind of my gateway into the industry.
Huh. That's amazing. And how long, this was in 2013, you said?
This was at the end of 2013, beginning of 2014.
Okay. And just to fast forward for a moment, you know, we're now in early 2017. What does the Blockchain Education Network look like today? You know, where is it? How big is it? What does it do?
It not only has survived all the craziness of the past 3 years in Bitcoin land, it is thriving. We've done probably over a half dozen hackathons with hundreds of thousands of dollars in prize money. We brought hundreds, if not thousands, of students into this industry We've helped launch the beginning of several startups that have raised tens of millions of dollars, including my own, Augur, stemmed out of the blockchain education network. So beyond the hackathon startups, we have students doing advocacy work, academic research. Several of our students have been published, especially at the graduate level. We've connected researchers with like graduate students. We've done partnerships with large companies in the industry and outside of it to help them get students involved in the space. What we do really depends on the school, but what we provide is a basis for any young person to get involved in this industry and get their peers involved as well.
Gotcha. Okay. What are some of the current projects that you think are the most ambitious or the most interesting to you?
So our new executive director, Jinglin Wang, she went to MIT and Wellesley. She is looking to do a summer boot camp in San Francisco for a bunch of students that want to learn about this technology, and has some awesome corporate backers. I mean, it's an ambitious project, especially at this time of year, but it looks like she's going to get it done. That would be a great way for students to spend their summer working on this tech. Another one of our students, Dominic, he has a supply chain, a blockchain called IOTA, and it's a really neat project. It's deeply ambitious once again, but it's really got me excited.
Oh, can you talk about IOTA or any of the other projects just in a little bit of detail to tell people what's going on with them?
Sure. One thing I really encourage these students to do is to constantly iterate. So we have another student team. It's called WeID, Distributed ID. And Distributed ID, they came out of our hackathon in St. Louis, Missouri. It was a supply chain hackathon. It was four students from my nonprofit, actually. They ended up taking first place in this hackathon against probably 80 other participants. And they ended up getting reached out to by several East Asian companies and wanted them to create a distributed identity solution. They're based out of Chicago now. Two of the original team members are still working on it. And it's kind of an example of how the nonprofit can take students that don't know each other, will pay for them to come to an event or a hackathon or a conference. They get to meet each other, and they can work on projects. Then they may end up building companies out of that. And so I think that's a really great example of what this nonprofit can do.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Who is able to join the Blockchain Education Network? Is it purely students, or do you have people from industry, just folks that aren't in college joining?
So the Blockchain Education Network is focused on kind of college or high school or graduate school clubs, that's the basic structure we've provided. Of course, if there are people in the industry, especially marketing and partnership departments, that want to work with our students, there's room for them to get involved and to engage our students. We offer all sorts of sponsorships, how we pay for students to do things. So from the partnership perspective, yes, but for the most part, this is definitely focused on kind of enrolled young people or people who are just recently out of college.
What happens when people graduate? Do you have a place for them to go, or is that not become an important factor yet?
We have job opportunities. Fortunately, of course, I work as a venture capitalist full-time, so I've got 40-plus portfolio companies, most of which are looking to hire, especially for engineering grads. So there's definitely room within this ecosystem to kind of absorb the talent that the Blockchain Education Network is producing. A lot of these students are entrepreneurial, however, and want to start their own ventures. Some of them have gone into Boost VC or Y Combinator, and launching companies in those accelerator sort of programs. But it really depends on what the students want to do, and we try to keep in contact with the larger entities such as like McKinsey, Bain, IBM, that are also trying to hire for this technology.
Okay, very good. And you said you sponsor hackathons. What happens at a hackathon? Like, what's a sample event? What goes on?
Sure. So either what we'll do is we'll host a distributed hackathon that will be online that students all over the world can participate in, or typically we'll partner with pre-existing hackathons wherever they may be in the world. It could be in Shanghai, or it could be in Singapore, or it could be in Nashville, Tennessee. Doesn't really matter. And what we'll do is we'll make sure our students know about these events, are able to attend these events almost always for free, and then make sure that they have a place to stay. And these students will come and they'll participate. You know, depending on the hackathon, some sponsors may stipulate that certain prizes are given for certain use cases. Most are broader and just require the use of blockchain technology in the hack. It really depends, but, you know, in the past two I've judged, one was a supply chain hackathon, one was a healthcare hackathon, but they both had to use the blockchain in their solution. It gives a good amount of flexibility, though having kind of experts on hand to help guide students and whoever else is creating a hack is definitely helpful, so they know what is a viable use case and what is not.
So how can people find out what events are coming? Go to a website, or what's the best way to start getting involved?
Yeah, they can go to blockchainedu.org, where we have a weekly newsletter. Then I check out bitcoinmagazine.com or CoinDesk, which both have event sections, and let people know about upcoming events.
Okay, very good.
I would encourage someone, maybe bitcoin.com, to create a repository of all the upcoming Bitcoin and blockchain hackathons, because there's not one consistent database for that. So,
It's a great idea. Okay.
Helpful hand.
To shift gears just a little bit, you said you're also a VC in this space. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that with Blockchain Capital, and, you know, what do you do as a VC?
That's exactly right. You know, after dropping out of school, building Augur, doing our crowd sale, we had about 2 years left, year and a half left of core development, and I don't write code. The business planning and kind of legal planning had been done for Augur, and so I was contacted by two different local VCs in San Francisco, both focusing on this technology, offering for me to become an entrepreneur in residence. Blockchain Capital made a kind of a more compelling pitch, and I ended up joining the team for what was supposed to be a three-month period. It ended up going so well, I brought in a few deals to the team, and they ended up offering me a full-time position at the firm. It's kind of like a permanent EIR position, with some of the roles of a partner or associate, helping that deal flow, meeting with portfolio companies, working with them, and bringing in new deals as well. And that's been a deeply rewarding experience. I've gotten to work in depth with several of our teams, and due to my EIR position, I've also been able to start a new software company recently, which I'll be announcing shortly. So it's been really fun. It's been really interesting to see the industry as a whole grow, especially from the venture capital perspective, because a lot has changed in the past year or half since I began my role. And taking kind of the macro view, how the industry is evolving, has been very informative to how I think about starting a new company in the future. And I've just learned a lot as well, because there's a lot you can learn creating a company. There's a lot you can learn from watching the creation of 40 companies. And that definitely. View definitely informed my thinking.
Yeah, can you talk about some of the learnings you've gotten from watching 40 companies? Maybe things that you were surprised about that people could find useful?
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the things that you don't realize until you've taken the VC perspective is how hard it is to hire. You know, when you're running a company, especially in the early stages, and your first few hires may actually be fairly easy because there are often people that you know. But once you start expanding outside of your network, or once your network dries out for the sort of kind of recruitment flow that you need, it gets really challenging. I'm fortunate enough to have a few of my good friends be CEOs of companies couple of which are actually in my portfolio. And, you know, just because they're my friends, I talked to this about them this about this extensively. And recruiting is just so incredibly hard. You know, if you're an engineer or business development person, you're often always getting hit up by recruiters, and you learn to hate them. And so then you think about it, and it's like, oh, wait, how am I going to hire in the future? It was something that I had never really given much thought to, because Augur was a fairly lean team. I think you can say we're only at like 8 or 9 people. And once you start having to hire at scale, getting past that first half dozen people, it gets really difficult. And making sure those initial hires are the right hires for scaling your organization, the future is even harder. Which is not something we had to do at Augur because we never planned to make the team that big. But once you start thinking about these are going to be your most senior hires in a year or two, and they're going to be running teams below them, you need to not be hiring for like people that listen to you do really well, but you actually need to be hiring for almost mini CEOs. Every early hire you do needs to be someone that is capable of managing a team, being responsible, taking initiative. Because if all that they're good at is doing what you say, that's not a recipe for successful scaling in the future. So hiring is one of those things that, as a first-time entrepreneur, you're not really ever prepared for. And it's one of the hardest things that you can ever kind of imagine as an executive.
Yeah, it makes sense, because I'm sure, you know, if someone has CEO capability or qualities, they may do their own venture. And they're rare people. It seems like very few people have those qualities.
Absolutely. The other day, I was working for one of my portfolio companies that happens to be run by two of my best friends. And you know what we were doing? We were literally going through a list of all recent Y Combinator graduating startups and just looking at to see if the companies had kind of wound down or failed. And we're reaching out to the CEOs to see if they were interested in a new venture. Because those are the exact sort of people that you want to help lead a new company.
So even if someone's been a CEO and they've failed, you still think they're good material to work with you?
If they're a CEO of a company that got into Y Combinator, absolutely. I mean, that YC has less than a 1% acceptance rate. You know, most startups are going to fail, whether or not they're good ideas, whether or not they're well-led. It's just it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time with the right company and the right idea and meeting the right people. It's, you know, serendipity is everything in the world of startups, and you can't knock someone for having tried. That would be foolish. You know, the fact that they tried in the first place is what's impressive.
Well, that's really good. That's a good way of thinking about it. And I guess that leads into my next question and probably answers it. So when you're looking at companies to invest in as a VC, now it probably makes sense why the number one thing you look for is the team and how strong they are and what their capabilities are, right?
Absolutely, because, you know, they may have had the best idea in the world 2 years ago, but maybe that idea is not so relevant anymore. Maybe there was a massive technological improvement to Bitcoin's protocol that kind of makes what they were doing irrelevant. Maybe there's been a shift from Bitcoin to blockchain, as we've seen happen in the past couple of years, and people are just not excited about like the consumer spending capabilities of Bitcoin. But maybe the back-end infrastructure of Bitcoin's blockchain is really exciting, and if you have a team that understands this technology and can iterate well, it doesn't matter if you're doing consumer payments 2 years ago, because you can now work on something entirely new. I mean, Chain.com was an API provider 2 years ago, and now they're literally doing business-to-business international payments for Visa. So, companies can pivot, they can shift strategies as long as the team is strong.
Gotcha, okay. So when you're evaluating a company to invest in, I would bet you're probably pretending, or you're actually saying, hey, I'm essentially hiring these people. Would I hire these people to work with me? And if so, then you consider investing in them.
That's exactly right. I think one of the best ways to think about investing is it's like same as working with people. If you can't imagine working with someone for the rest of your life, you shouldn't work with them for a day. It's the same with investing. It's like marriage. You know, you are you are buying a stake in this person's future and in this person's company, and you need to have faith in them for the long haul, even if things go south.
Hmm. Very insightful. That's really good. Are you able to talk about any of the funding that you've done? Any particular projects that you think are excite you personally more than others?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, well, obviously what Chain has done is remarkable. I mean, 2017 is going to be the year that blockchain technology becomes real, and Chain is absolutely leading the way in that regard. Visa's partnership with them is massive. The fact that all international business payments are still soon going to be going over Chain's blockchain rails, I mean, that's remarkable. The recent partnership that the DTCC is doing with IBM and Axone for putting all credit default swaps on the blockchain, also just a massive use case. But probably my favorite use case to go live this year will be Abra. Abra is the Western Union PayPal killer. I mean, it is. If it succeeds, it will be a grand slam of an investment and a world-changing technology. It takes the Uber model for calling a car, but for doing international payments. If you're and for unbanked people, this is revolutionary. You open up your phone. You find someone nearby with what you think is just digital cash. You don't even know it's Bitcoin. You meet up with them. You give them cash. They send this digital cash to your phone. And then you can send it back home. And in a similar manner, your family back home finds a nearby teller that will issue them their local currency. It is the solution to what is right now an incredibly predatory remittance industry. And it has me so incredibly excited. Abra goes live in a month, and I think the technology could prove to really be a game changer for the underbanked.
Yeah, you talked about BTCC's partnership, you know, with IBM and Axone, and you talked about Chain partnering with Visa. It seems like in order for these, for blockchain technology to really become widespread, they have to partner with the existing infrastructure, the big guys.
I've been saying this for 2 years now. In order for Bitcoin and blockchain technology to be successful, it's not like the Facebook or Uber model where you can disintermediate the incumbents. This is a back-end infrastructure improvement. It's a protocol improvement. In order for this technology to be successful, you have to work with the incumbent. There's so much beyond just the technology that goes into building these companies. You know, Facebook and Uber, they're pretty much pure technology plays. You know, you get drivers or you get your users, and you can disintermediate the incumbents before you. But people don't just suddenly go from having a bank account to going to using Bitcoin. That's just, I mean, some people have done that, but it's not practical. In order for this technology to really thrive, there has to be a middle ground in which partnerships with the incumbents enable first-time users and back-end users, such as large financial institutions, to onboard this technology and make it real for consumers and for themselves. It doesn't just happen overnight. The banks aren't going to suddenly throw all their technology out the window for this new tech, and people aren't going to suddenly abandon their banks just because this new technology exists. So you have to be practical in how you view this technology being adopted. And I think most straightforwardly, it's by recognizing that incumbents can be good allies.
That's great. That's great to hear. It sounds like in order for Bitcoin and other blockchain technologies to become widespread as well, that the technology side needs to be hidden from the public. You know, like you said, in the case of Abra, they don't care that it's Bitcoin maybe underlying the network. They just care, you know, I have my currency, I want to send this currency and receive it, and that's it. Do you think that in order for Bitcoin to become widespread, it has to be kind of under the radar like this?
Absolutely. Most people don't know the difference between reply and reply all on email. You think they're going to figure out public and private key cryptography? Absolutely not. It's not a reasonable expectation. You know, even as a technologist, I often struggle with some of the more straightforward elements of Bitcoin's technology. It can be disconcerting sending large sums of money over the network just because, you know, there is no way, there's no undo button, and people aren't comfortable with that. So until the infrastructure reaches the point where people really feel comfortable with what they're doing, it's incredibly user-friendly, yeah, everything needs to be hidden. And I think Bitcoin really is better served being in the back end of things.
Okay. So do you think that, when do you think Bitcoin will become widespread where, you know, I can go to a merchant and say, hey, do you accept Bitcoin? And they say, of course, and pay for, you know, normal everyday stuff. Or do you think it won't evolve like that? Do you think it'll just come in the form of Abra or something else?
It could, but Bitcoin is a really great digital gold. And, you know, I don't know if it needs to play a greater role in that, especially because you can have these sort of stable coins, as they're called, built on top of Bitcoin or Ethereum that allow you to have a currency, a cryptocurrency that doesn't have the volatility of these tokens. But let's say in 20 years or something, and 5% of all assets in most hedge funds are crypto tokens, and Bitcoin has a market capitalization of $500 billion, and it's fairly muted in its volatility, then I could see it being an option. But for someone like me, I think about Bitcoin, and I think about how I'd much rather hold it than spend it. Now, obviously, if I had a wallet that bought more Bitcoin every time I spent it, which I've been kind of imploring several Bitcoin wallet companies to do, I would definitely consider potentially spending Bitcoin more frequently. But considering that the economics of Bitcoin indicate that the price will always go up, you need to find ways to incentivize people to spend it better. So I think, one, you need less volatility. Two, you need greater incentives for using the cryptocurrency. And thirdly, you know, I think that the market capitalization has to be much larger. The volatility that exists today is just not tenable as a consumer token.
When do you guess that these three items will come to pass, if ever?
I think we could see it in the next 10 to 20 years. I think that's perfectly possible. But like I said, if it remains a digital gold, that's also okay. But it's definitely not happening any time sooner than a decade because the market capitalization needs to go up so tremendous. But then again, I have a friend who's a CEO in the industry. He's been in the industry since 2011, and he's been pretty good at making price calls. He's convinced in the next 2 to 3 years we could see $50,000 of Bitcoin. And that would put the market cap at around $500 billion. So, you know, it's not impossible to imagine.
Any other questions or insights that you have that you want to share? Or do you think that it's been a pretty good line of questioning so far?
I think this is the right path. But, yeah, I mean, don't expect this technology to be adopted overnight. And I think most people have reached that conclusion that it's going to take some time. But if you buy Bitcoin, you hold it, you educate people about it, slowly, you know, we will see this continued ascendancy of Bitcoin's price market capitalization rise, and the technology will continue to find good use cases, which is what's really important, that as the back-end protocol functionality gets proven out, the greater utility people will see as holding it as a digital gold.
Okay, well, very good. Jeremy Gardner, BTC Media, Blockchain Capital, Blockchain Education Network. I appreciate you taking the time to do this interview.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Bitcoin.com podcast. Visit Bitcoin.com today, the number one place in the world to learn about Bitcoin. Open your first wallet, buy your first Satoshis, and get involved in the Bitcoin ecosystem that is changing the world as we know it.